Hello, everyone. Just a quick word before we get started with this week's episode. We want to tell you that we're putting on a show in conjunction with the Everett Music Initiative up in Everett, Washington, at the Anchor Pub on April 20th. Yeah, that's right, 4/20. Awesome, right? You like how I just left a little space for you to just think about it just for a second? It's going to be a great show. The Young Evils are going to be there, as well as the Learning Team. So come on up, 4/20 at the Anchor Pub in Everett. All right, on with the show. Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode number 142 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Boom, indeed. Holy smokes, people. We've got a great show planned for you this week, man, oh man. The one and the only Mark Arm of the band Mudhoney will be joining us shortly here in Dining Room Studios. I don't know if he knew he was coming on a podcast. So that was a little weird when he walked up here and asked me if they had changed where Cairo was doing their broadcasting, but it was a good conversation nonetheless. Very, very sweet guy. The new album, Mudhoney, Vanishing Point, out now, out in stores on Sub Pop Records, is fantastic. They sent me this record a little while ago. We actually recorded this episode, I believe, a week ago, and they sent me the record. The Sub Pop sent me this record, the new Mudhoney record. And guys, I can't tell you how much I enjoy it. It's so good. It's like, it basically, when I turned it on, the first song brought me back to being a 13-year-old boy in my room, in my bedroom, just rocking out to some honest grunge music. It was it's a great album. I hope you guys go out and get it. It's called Vanishing Point, and it's available now. And so we'll be featuring music from said album throughout the episode. But yeah, Mark Arm. I was a bit nervous for this one. Been a fan of Mudhoney for many years, and I didn't know, anything really about Mark. I did a little bit of research, but I didn't know what he would want to talk to. Even Sub Pop, you know, when we were lining all this stuff up, they said, look, you know, he doesn't really, he wants to do the interview, he just doesn't really want it to be about the 90s. And so I was like, that's cool, man, I dig that. I don't really like talking about the 90s either, like, you know, with that's not something I would want to talk to Mudhoney about. You can go to any website and find that information out, how they felt about the grunge era. And, you know, I've left the grunge era behind me. I look forward to the future and am now in the present. I mean, I'm still interested in stuff that happened back then, but, you know, for the most part, I've left it behind. And we get into that a little bit. I do ask Mark later in the episode about how he feels about talking about that constantly, and he has some interesting things to say, and I, of course, bumble through that section of the interview because I don't want to piss anybody off. So yeah, it's good, man. It's super good. Mark turned out to be just a sweetheart of a dude, and willing to talk about pretty much anything. God, I hope we can talk to him again. I hope he didn't walk out of here going, shit, that was a waste of my time. That's what I hope, people. I hope you guys had a great week. I have. Well, no. Actually, I take that back. This week has sucked. It's been so busy. Lining stuff up for the show, doing my day job, which is just busier than shit right now. And then our car started making this weird noise. And my wife, the beautiful and smart Mairead, took the car up to the mechanic. And they gave us a loaner car. Everything was cool. We were just like, hey, it's making this weird sound. Check it out. They call Mairead back, and Mairead gives me a ring and says, okay, don't panic. But they say that the front differential is out, and they need a complete overhaul on the front differential. I don't know what the front differential is. It just sounds important, right? So anyway, well, it's going to cost like $4,200. What? $4,200? That's like a third of the cost of the car. But at the time, I'm thinking, well, we need that, right, to drive the thing, so maybe we should just do it. The next day rolls around, and I have second thoughts, and I start thinking, man, they might be trying to pull one over on my wife. And so we go and we get another estimate, $1,800. What the shit? People are still doing this. And I don't know if it's, I don't know if it has anything to do with my wife being a woman, or I don't have, you know, maybe they just saw a sucker. Because she didn't really know what she was talking about at all. Maybe they just saw a sucker. But shit, man, that's shady, right? That's bad. That's bad news. And I came on this, I wanted to do this episode and I wanted to mention the name of the mechanic. But I'm not going to do that. I've decided in the last few seconds that I'm not going to say the name of the auto mechanic, because that's kind of shady as well. I don't want to sink to their level, right? But man, god damn it. That's bad stuff. It left a very sour taste in my mouth dealing with that mechanic. Anyway, I did get a nice note on my scooter the day that we got all that news, and I'll read it to you. It was just left right on the steering column of my scooter at the transit center. It says, and I quote, "Hello. I wanted to say thank you for always parking in this spot. Cars barely fit here, but your motorcycle fits beautifully. Hope you have a good weekend, Lisa." And that, my friends, made my day. After a very stressful week, I got this little tiny note on my moped who Lisa so kindly calls a motorcycle, which is awesome. So thank you, Lisa, if you're out there, I love you. Thank you so much. You made my Friday. You made my Friday so much better, and my weekend for that matter. And thanks for calling it a motorcycle, because man, you know, riding around on a scooter is emasculating sometimes. Yeah, it is. It is. Oh man. Okay. Well, let's get to it, shall we? Like I said, Vanishing Point, the new Mudhoney album. They've been together for 25 years, guys. Man. Oh, and they're still putting out great stuff. They still do a killer live show. So if you get a chance, they're going on tour in support of this album, and they'll be on tour right now as you're hearing this. So go and check them out. This song is called Chardonnay. And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears with Mark Arm of Mudhoney. Hold it together, Aaron. Hold it together. We'll be right back.
Oh!
right, welcome back. Welcome back to the Dining Room Studios. Joining me here in the Greenwood, high atop the Greenwood neighborhood here in beautiful Seattle, Washington, is Mr. Mark Arm, the lead singer for Mudhoney. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming, man. I'm sorry that you didn't know that this was a podcast.
Oh, it doesn't really matter one way or the other.
Right when he walked in, folks, he asked me if this was where Cairo now resides in my condo. Well, welcome, sir. New album, Vanishing Point, comes out April 2nd on Sub Pop. Really super good, man.
Oh, great.
This took me listening to this the last couple days. Actually, I just got it. Actually, that's a lie. I just got it yesterday.
No.
But listening to it for the last day or so has taken me back to being like a 13-year-old in my bedroom with my cassette player with like maybe 13 or 14 different little tiny speakers that I have taken out of different boom boxes and stuff and connected all into one little unit all around my room. And I got to say, it's fantastic. I love it.
Awesome.
Yeah. Great job, man. So it's been 5 years since the last one came out.
Yeah. Time seems to just sort of disappear when you're older.
I can vouch for that. Why did it take so long? Is there any one reason or just taking a break?
No, we weren't taking a break. I mean, we were as busy as we usually are, mm-hmm. which at this point isn't as busy as we used to be.
Yeah.
You know, at this point we're all like, I'm the oldest. I'm in my early 50s and everybody else is in their late 40s. And
yeah,
everyone except for me has kids and, you know, some of us have jobs that are pretty real.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like Guy, works at Harborview.
Oh, he does.
Yeah. And so, we only get a certain amount of time to actually take off and go on tour or,
mm-hmm.
and Steve moved to Portland. So that makes rehearsal just a little bit more difficult. Anytime we get together to practice, you know, he's looking at a 6-hour round trip.
Right. Right.
So sometimes he'll come up and stay for 2 days in a row.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's got kids to take care of too. So he can't
just stay
up here forever.
How does that work out? Like when you guys are writing like songs for this, how does that work out then with Steve being down in Portland and stuff? I mean, do you guys all bring little bits that you just kind of write on your own together and then form a song out of that? Or does somebody?
Yeah. The way we work usually is, you know, we'll get together at our practice place and, someone will have some sort of an idea. It might be just one riff or a couple of things that work, you know, in succession or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then everyone starts kind of playing along and putting their input into it. And, you know, sometimes it blooms into something fantastic. And sometimes it's just, that just needs to be left here.
Right. Right. Yeah. Or we'll just play this one live.
You know, we write collaboratively, you know,
Has it always been that way?
It's always been that way.
Yeah.
There's no songwriter in the band that's like dictates to everyone what they mm-hmm. need to play or mm-hmm. anything. I prefer working like that, you know?
Yeah.
I think the if you have the right people, at least the end product is product. The end result is something greater than like, I mean, I've been surprised how stuff I've brought in has gone into a direction that was not something I anticipated and was better than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
You know, like I thought I had something that was pretty cool and it turned into something, you know, that I like slipping away the original riff for that kind of, you know, right at the end, there's that the rhythm for the guitar solo,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of a slower, heavier, sludgier thing. And that was the original rhythm for the song at the beginning. And then Dan and Guy came up with a sort of jazzy, jazzier feel to it, you know, kind of a more Mitch Mitchell, Noel Redding sort of thing.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, it sounds way better like that than it did with my original idea.
Yeah, yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
And it's the same core, it's the same group of guys.
We have, right? I mean, guys, we've had guys, a bass player since 2001.
So. Oh, really? Oh, okay.
But
I did not.
Everybody else has been the same since 1988.
Yeah, yeah. So everybody gets along.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the most part, anyway.
Oh.
Except for all those old bass players.
Well, it's just the one. And we still get along with Matt. He just didn't want to do it anymore. You know?
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, let's go back. I want to talk about you, Mark. Because you grew up here in Washington, right?
Yeah.
Was it's either Kenmore or Kirkland?
Kirkland.
Kirkland.
Yeah. It was actually unincorporated King County
back then.
Yeah. Lake.
Yeah, yeah. So what was life like for you, for little Mark Arm in Kirkland, Washington?
How little do you want to go? you know, it was kind of, I think, probably a typical suburban Seattle area kind of existence. You know, my dad worked at Boeing. When we first moved here, my mom didn't work, but then eventually she became an Avon lady and then eventually, like, you know, worked in an office somewhere.
Mm-hmm. When did you move to Washington? What age were you?
I was four.
Four. Oh, yeah. Okay. So you're from here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it, your parents moved here for work or something?
Yeah. What? My dad retired from the Air Force and in 66 and got a job at Boeing. And
oh, cool.
Moved here.
Nice. Excellent. Engineer?
Yep.
No kidding.
Industrial engineer. Whatever Man. That is. I could never figure out what it was.
Right, right. Was there a lot of music in the household
as a
kid?
There was a ton of music, but it was all classical. And my mom...
Like Mozart.
Like Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms, you know.
Really?
Like, you know, classic King radio.
Uh-huh.
That was a radio station. And KOW... I think back then played a lot more classical music and wasn't so much of a talk station.
Right, right.
So that was, and my dad, you know, he couldn't have cared less about music. He pretty much listened to talk radio like Cairo and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Or news radio.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. The age of like Edward R. Murrow too, right? I think that was Cairo. Pretty sure. Wasn't that Cairo?
Yeah,
or was he a TV guy?
He was a TV guy, and that was earlier.
Oh, okay.
I mean, in terms of TV, it was like the age of Walter Cronkite.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. So how did rock and roll kind of come into being for you?
Oh, you know, I don't know. Someone was asking me about this the other day, and I kind of remember like just being like about 4 years old and just freshly moved to this country because we're stationed in Germany and my mom's German.
Oh, really?
You know, so.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And somehow was singing, like, even though I hadn't heard the song, just probably heard it from some other kid or something, singing, "She loves you. Yeah, yeah, yeah." Like, in a, like not really knowing the song, but just kind of like the Beatles.
Yeah. Reciting the chorus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or something.
And
yeah.
then, I started getting into, you know, at a small age, like getting into top 40 radio.
Uh-huh.
And we had, you know, rock music wasn't allowed in the house. So I would crawl into our Volkswagen Beetle because you could turn on the radio without putting a key in the ignition and listen to the radio.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And just totally drain the battery.
Well, I don't think that little radio in that car drained the battery, but, you know, just... Listen to top 40 radio and then started gravitating to the songs that were a little more rocking, like, you know, like Mama Told Me Not to Come by Three Dog Night or The Locomotion by Grand Funk, you know, those, you know, as opposed to like, The Carpenters or whatnot.
Uh-huh. So rock and roll was not allowed in your household.
It was not allowed in the
house. Was that dad or mom?
That was all mom.
Oh,
my,
really?
My dad probably wouldn't have cared less.
Yeah. Yeah.
He would just be like, "Oh, it's weird what the kids are doing. I don't know."
Yeah, yeah. Was it like religious reasons or just
no?
Or just,
not
she
at all.
Just did not like it at all.
She just thought it was shitty music.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she she doesn't even like jazz. She doesn't like it. It's not a matter of like technical proficiency or something like that. It's like, to my mom, music was sort of frozen in time with the classical greats.
Really?
You know, that probably ended in the late 1800s, maybe early part of the 19th century. You know, that would have been, you know, after that, the classical music got a little weird with, you know, Stravinsky and stuff, and she wasn't into that at all.
Mm-hmm. That's so funny.
Yeah.
So it caused you to rebel, obviously.
I think so, yeah. It was a forbidden fruit that tasted so damn good.
Yeah, yeah. And by rebellion, we're just talking about going out to the car and listening to Top 40.
Yeah. You know, well, you know, it... You know, I learned to lie the first record I bought was, and I bought 7 inches because I could actually, you know, put them under my jacket and sneak them into the house.
Right.
Was, you know, Yo-Yo by the Osmonds, you know, which is a pretty tame song.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, it's like, oh, I like that song. I heard it on the radio. I want to be able to listen to it whenever I want. And I'll just sneak it into the house. And then,
then I
had to wait till my parents left for me to be able to play the, to play the single.
Oh my God, that's crazy. So were your parents musical? I mean, was your mom musical?
Oh, my mom was very musical. Like she had studied opera.
Like and oh, really?
She was on track to be an opera singer, and her career was kind of interrupted with World War II. And
wow,
she started up again after the war, but you know, I guess she was a little too old to have like a, you know, really kick off her career.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what she says. I don't know if that's
true.
But, cause you know, Susan Boyle.
I mean, yeah, she did it, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's super impressive. So do you think you picked up anything from your mom then? From musically?
The one thing she told me about singing was to sing from your diaphragm.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
what does that even mean? I've heard that so many times. I don't even know what it means.
I mean, at this point, like the way I'm putting quotes around the word. The way I sing is, you know, it's something I've just been doing for so long. But I think it's just using like the full force of your lungs, you know, from the bottom up instead of singing from the top of your lungs, but just like, using your full breath.
I see that still just confuses the shit out of me. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
I'd have to take a class maybe.
Yeah, I don't know.
So when did you like pick up a guitar? When was the first time you picked up a guitar then?
I was forced to take piano lessons.
Oh, were you?
As a kid.
Oh, okay.
My mom had these thoughts that I would be the next Van Cliburn or something like that.
Right.
And you know, I was okay, but I wasn't great at it.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually got old enough to say, I don't want to do this anymore. And that was probably around eighth grade, you know, able to just put my foot down and have it stick. I remember in the fourth grade, there was a ukulele class offered in my elementary school. And I was like, I'm going to play ukulele because that's almost like guitar.
And it looked easier, right?
Well, there was actually a kid I knew who had a little electric guitar, and I was like, oh, man, you know. That's,
yeah.
But there's no way I could have had one of those in the house.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Your mom would have forbade that.
Yeah.
So you started with ukulele then? Like with the string instrument?
No, I mean, I played ukulele for like a quarter or I don't even know if like, elementary school is broken up into quarters or semesters, but you know, like a section, and that was kind of it.
Yeah. So being forced into music didn't kind of sully that your musical experience then?
No,
because usually when you talk to people that have like been forced into playing an instrument, like they, you know, usually they're done.
Right.
You know?
Right.
In
well,
their older
you,
years,
you know the. You know, I've heard, like, my wife, she took piano lessons. It was like, apparently her piano teacher was horrible. And my piano teacher was great.
Yeah.
You know, she was really encouraging and understanding. It was like, the weirder thing was, like, at home, my mom, who was, like, this really strict German.
Yeah.
Also you know, she had me pretty late in life and was menopausal and was just on edge the whole time. So if I like, you know, hit the wrong note, you know, and she knew this music back and forth.
Right.
She would just scream from the kitchen like, B flat, B sharp, B sharp. You know, I'm just like,
So she knew it. She knew it. She would listen to you. She was like constantly.
Actually, there's no
B
sharp. I just realized that.
Oh yeah, it goes. It's C. Nice catch though.
Yeah, nice catch. Yeah.
At least you caught it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Nobody will judge you. You're Mark Arm. Shit, man. So when did you finally pick up a guitar then? How old were you?
I picked up a guitar like in, actually not till after high school, like right.
Oh, really?
Summer after high school.
Yeah. Yeah. So 18.
Yeah.
What, 18, 19 years old or something.
Yeah. 18. Yeah. My friends and I, in high school, a couple of friends, this is in Bellevue Christian High School too.
Oh like, yeah. Yeah. I work over in Bellevue.
Hmm.
I work over in Bellevue.
Right.
Yeah.
They had this imaginary band named after a math teacher called Mr. Up and the Calculations.
Oh, okay. And yeah,
it would,
yeah.
You know, it.
I've heard parts of this story.
Right. You know, and it, you know, like some of these guys were in like a French class that went to France for a couple of weeks or whatever. And that was, you know, Mr. Up's European tour. It was all just purely made up stuff. And eventually, a couple of us started. I mean, we would be at our friend Darren's house, and he had a drum kit, and he was the only person who really knew what he was doing with his instrument. He was actually a really, really good drummer. And we would make noises with whatever we could find, you know, and record them on like crappy cassette players. And eventually Smitty and I went in halves on a guitar and an amp, and we were kind of like switching off back and forth playing guitar or just singing.
And obviously that had to stay at Smitty's house.
That what?
The guitar had to stay at Smitty's house.
Well, right? Yeah, it was actually all over at Darren's house.
Oh, okay.
Because that's
okay.
Where the drums were, you know?
Right, right.
And by this point, you know, the genie was way out of the bottle. Like,
yeah.
You know, at some point in like seventh or eighth grade, my mom was kind of finally like, she presented me with an Elton John greatest hits record because like she remembered that at one point I was into Elton John.
Right.
At this point I was, you know, I'd kind of moved down the line a little bit. And she said, you know, okay, I'll let you buy your first record.
Uh-huh.
And so I had the single for for Fox on the Run, and then Ballroom Blitz came out. So I was like, "Oh, I'm getting sweet Desolation Boulevard," you know. So that was a lucky first album, you know. So when people ask like, "What's your first album you bought?" you know, it's not an embarrassing answer.
Yeah, yeah, totally, totally.
So you know, by the time I was like, you know, towards the end of high school,
was out of the bag.
Yeah, out of the bag.
Yeah.
You know, but when the band started, like neither of us had any idea how the guitar worked or about tuning or anything like that. Yeah. And
what'd you guys buy? Was it a little?
It was a guitar we got in a pawn shop called an Orpheus.
Orpheus. I used to have an Orpheus mandolin.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. I sold it. It was a cool little. Little mandolin though, that's for sure. Little Japanese made thing.
Yeah. I kind of assumed it was Japanese. It probably said made in Japan on it. And then we had like we would hang out at Roboto Records in Bellevue, and the people who worked there were all in bands. Like the two owners, John and Helena, were in Student Nurse, and a couple of the other guys were in the Color Plates, and that was like an encouraging group of kind of mentors in a way, you know.
Yeah.
You'd go there and they'd be completely non-judgmental about the records you were buying.
Uh-huh.
But they'd also kind of like prod you in directions
right.
That would be, you know, like we got at the same time that we got like turned on to like punk rock stuff, we also got turned on to Albert Eiler and Ornette Coleman, you know, kind of free jazz stuff. So, you know, that was eye opening.
Yeah,
you know, the, you know, when you're kind of coming from that angle, you know, not knowing how to tune the guitar is doesn't really matter.
Right, exactly.
We're just making noise.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly.
One of the funniest stories from that era to me is one of our friends, Peter, he was involved in the group and then eventually said, you know, I got to bow out, you know, because I just don't want to make music in my life. And this is before we ever even played a show or anything. And I was just, you know, thinking like, you're out of your mind. You know, okay, there's no way this is going to lead to anything. And then like, you know, here I am 30 something years later. And I'm playing music all the time.
And you're on a podcast.
Yeah, I'm a podcast about it.
So did you know at an early age that this is what you kind of wanted to do? What was the moment, the turning moment that
this is something we were doing for fun and to entertain ourselves and, you know, we loved music and stuff, but you know, before punk rock, there was this whole idea that like you have to be a master musician to even like be in a band. And how do you, you know, and the catch 22 was like, how do you become this master musician without being in a band with someone? You know,
right, right. Yeah.
It, you know, all those people who were like technically proficient dudes in the 70s, they all started in like crappy garage bands in the 60s. You know, it wasn't like they were all like instantly Alan Holdsworth or Steve Howe, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
They were, you know, they started somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody has to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. It all starts usually in a garage or a basement.
Right. Or a bedroom.
Or a bedroom. Yeah, yeah, totally, totally. Oh, that's cool, man. Well, hey, let's do this. Let's go with our second musical break. We're featuring music from the new album, Vanishing Point, by Mudhoney. This song is called... Oh, wait. I had it written down. See, this is the great thing about podcasting, Mark, is that you can say whatever you want, and you cannot have all your notes in order. This is called The Only Son of the Widow from Nain by Mudhoney, and we will be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us.
Last thing I know, I was having a blast.
All right, welcome back. Joining me here in the dining room studios, once again, is Mark Arm from the band Mudhoney. One of my favorite bands of all time, by the way, sir. So it's an honor to have you here.
No.
If I didn't say that already.
I was waiting for you to say one of my favorite bands is...
Limp Bizkit. Oh, huge man. Limp Bizkit fan. No, I have this, and I failed to look for it before you got here, but I have the first, one of the first CDs that I got because it was, you know, one of the first CDs that I ever bought was $5 Bob's Mock Cooter Stew.
Okay.
Do you remember this?
I'm sorry.
You're no, sorry?
No, go ahead, go ahead.
No, I loved this. And it was basically just an EP, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, maybe five songs or something like that, or four songs on there?
Yeah, something like that.
I still have the CD, but I failed to find the jewel case and everything today. But I was looking for that online, and it's nowhere to be found. It's not even on Sub Pop's.
Well, no, Sub Pop didn't put it out.
Oh, really?
No, it was on Reprise.
Oh, okay. The same label that put out Piece of Cake, right?
Right. It was a record after Piece of Cake.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Oh, for some reason, I thought it was before it. Hmm. Oh. No, but that is like, I love that record.
Yeah.
Why did you say sorry?
Well, I just think we did Piece of Cake, and we knew it was going to be a little while before we had like a full-length album.
So it was like songs that didn't make it onto the full length?
Well, no, our A&R guy was like, and we had a couple of songs. We had basically those four or five songs. And our A&R guy was like, well, why don't you put out something in the meantime? And to me, those four or five songs were like kind of in all different directions. There's like a Hawkwind kind of song. There's like a sort of a country thing, if I recall correctly, and it didn't seem like a cohesive thing. And I think like if we actually just saved those songs for the next album, it would have, you know, there would be more songs that are like each other or kind of in between, you know, to make a better flowing record.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, wasn't, and there was a version of Acetone on that one too, right?
No. That ends Piece of Cake.
Okay. Okay. I love that song. I love that song. So let's kind of skip over the 90s because I was told by the PR guy at Sub Pop that you didn't want to come in and have another whole thing about the 90s.
Well, that's fair enough. I mean, I feel like I've...
You've done that.
Talked about it at length.
Yeah. Everybody has.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about that, though. Like, what... you've got to be tired of it, right? Does it bug... Does it...
Well, the weird thing is I just don't ever really think about it, except that when, like, I'm asked about it.
Right,
you know,
right.
It doesn't mean all that much to me, but it seems to mean a lot to other people.
Yeah.
You know, like, the whole thing that happened here in Seattle and stuff.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, too. Like, it's you know... I mean, I've largely forgotten about it pretty much. You know, I'm still a fan of the bands that came out of that era.
Right, right, right.
Especially in this in the city, you know. I mean, it's hard to kind of escape from. But at some point, you got to realize, too, that like, and this is no slight on you or anything, but I do get annoyed at people who are still stuck in that era.
Oh, you know? Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you got to realize that era meant a lot to a lot of people, too.
Well,
it reached a lot of
people. Weird thing, like, I think where a lot of people, some people just sort of, like, sort of, you know, not a lot of people, but some people, like, their kind of growth is sort of stunted at a certain point. Like, I remember when I first moved to West Seattle, I used to see this guy walking around the neighborhood all the time. And this is like, you know, maybe 93, 94. And he was wearing like, you know, had kind of long hair, parted in the middle, a mustache. And this is summertime. He wears super, super short shorts and tall ass tube socks.
Yeah.
You know, and like Nikes from like 77. The guy looked like he was just from like the summer of 77.
Yeah, yeah.
Not the punk rock summer of 77.
Right,
but
right.
The, you know, the the Camaro summer of 77, uh-huh. you know, and it was just really weird to me, you know, like,
yeah, yeah. And so you're saying, like,
he doesn't know how gross his shorts look right now.
You know what, though? But that guy is back in style right now.
Yeah. But he's a lot older, and it's still unsightly.
Right, right. Yeah, now things are hanging lower out of the short shorts, which we don't have to go into that. But so I kind of want to skip over the 90s a little bit and get to, you know, where you guys are at now as a band and, you know, musically, I guess, in your career. Like, where you went through this huge era where you're super popular. Everybody really knows who you are. You're kind of held as an icon, right? Which I've heard you don't really prescribe to. You don't think of yourself as a rock icon.
Who would?
Right?
Anybody who would has got to be a horrible human being.
Kanye West. Kanye West. Perfect example. Yeah. I don't see you as a Kanye West. But you know,
is Kanye West a rock icon?
Maybe more pop icon.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. But I mean,
you know, like, you, who would buy into that image of themselves? It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it seems like some people do, you know, a fair amount of them do.
But does it feel, I mean, when somebody says that to you, does it feel good to hear that kind of stuff?
To hear what?
Like that you're admired and your music is loved.
Well,
and
that's nice to hear for sure.
You're thought of as a Seattle rock legend.
You know, we played with Motorhead a couple shows a couple years ago, and mm-hmm. You know, Lemmy was basically said, you know, if you hang around long enough, they'll start calling you a legend. That's like, oh, that's a pretty accurate take.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. But you're in a world too, like being in the position that you guys are in now, right, and have been for some time. You know, it's kind of a mysterious career to a lot of people.
Right. You
know? I mean, it's being up in front of people, you know, there's all sorts of stories about glamour and glitz and partying and, you know, everything, you know, living the life of the rock star.
Right. You know, we're kind of like middle class people who are in a middle class rock band. You know.
And you're still doing it.
There are some things we can't afford.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're lucky. We're in a really great position. People still seem interested in having us come to their cities in all kinds of crazy places all over the world. Mm-hmm. And so we get to go a couple times a year, you know, like we're going to do a 3-week tour of Europe in May. We did a tour of Australia December before last. And then went back again in the summer for 2 shows. That was a crazy trip, like going all the way to Australia for 2 shows.
Man.
It was kind of...
Was that for a festival or just for two shows?
They brought us down for a festival shows. And then they added like a club show in Melbourne.
Oh, cool.
So that was... I mean, just the logistics of it was just like flying from here to Melbourne, having one night there.
Yeah.
Playing the next night. And then for some reason we had the festival. We didn't like keep a day between the two. So we had to fly up to Brisbane and then from Brisbane drive 2.5 hours to the festival site. Play a show, drive back to Brisbane 2.5 hours, and then the next morning got on a plane home.
Oh my God. How long is that flight?
Like 13 hours.
Oh my God.
14 hours.
I can't,
you know, the whole trip, if you know, you're making it from here, you end up going to LA or San Francisco and hanging out there for a couple hours.
Right, right.
You know, so it's a real long.
Oh yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally. Is it still worth it to you? Like, do you still just enjoy the the touring and,
all
that stuff?
Yeah. I really like playing live a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's much more of an immediate thing. I mean, I like recording and writing songs and putting a record together, but there's not the immediate, like, feedback that you get from the crowd.
Yeah.
But there's a whole different experience, which is like watching something kind of come out of nothing, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Totally. So it's still a very rewarding experience for all of you.
If it wasn't, we wouldn't be doing it.
That's true.
You know?
Yeah.
It's not like this is how we make our living at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice addition,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it's not it. And actually, I think that's a real freeing thing because we can just concentrate on the music that we want to play and that we want to hear without thinking about, you know, if our whole thing was just about, if our own source of income was just the band, then we would, you know, be thinking about things in a different way, I imagine.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. Now, has that changed? Because, like I said before, you guys have been around. You just had your 25th anniversary of being a band.
Yeah.
Right? Was that yesterday?
No. We mark our 25th, our anniversary on New Year's Day.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because that's...
Wow, I was like, way off.
Well, after Green River broke up, Steve and Dan and I started kind of getting together a couple times, probably in November mm-hmm. of 87, but then the first time we actually got together with all four original members was on New Year's Day, 1988. So that's like where we mark it.
Gotcha. Cool. But so, I mean, you guys have been around for a long time. You've been through a lot of different trends in music and a lot of different trends in how people consume music as well.
Right.
So like... with iTunes and things that are gotten are downloaded illegally and things like that, have you been able to really notice a difference in what you guys take in?
Well, you know, our records don't sell as much as they used to, so mm-hmm. you know, I mean, this isn't 91 and 2 anymore, you know, where, you know, you could be Billy Bob and the Fuckheads and put out a record and it's like, hey, it's from Seattle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I'm sorry, Mark. I don't want to talk about the 90s, okay?
I just want to talk about Billy Bob and the Fuckheads. So it's hard to say exactly, you know, I don't think we're getting, our income is diminished because of downloading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know,
does that bother you at all? Like if people illegally downloaded, like
there's not really a whole lot I can do about it. So I can't really.
So it's just not something you really,
I can't concern myself bother with it,
yourself
you know?
With. Yeah.
And you know, to be fair, sometimes I'll go, get something off the web or copy someone else's CD or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's mm-hmm. generally stuff that's out of print or,
yeah.
you know, so here's this weird band that, you know, was from the Ukraine in 1974 or whatever, you know.
Right.
Although I actually don't have a band from the Ukraine in 74. But like Switzerland in like 72 or whatever.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, totally. Totally. So, like I said, I guess, 24 years then you guys have been together? Or did you sell it? You celebrated your 25th this last New Year's.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
25 years, man.
Yeah.
Was it exciting to reach that moment for you guys or was it just something that you just kind of were like, wow, that's been a long time.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't like particularly exciting.
Yeah.
The 1st of January, it's like, oh, there it is. I'm hungover.
Right on. So what's
you know, we weren't all together on New Year's Day this year.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, I'm just asking you personally. Like, it seems like, you know, 25 years of being a band that's still, you know, revered in a lot of circles. is a pretty cool accomplishment.
Yeah, but you know, last year was 24, and next year will be 26, right. No one's going to be talking
about 20 was
that.
Still a lot of years of being a band.
You know, it's like, for some reason, like 10, 20, 25, probably 30, then 50 maybe. You know.
Do you think you'll be around for 50?
Well, I mean, I hope I am. We would have to radically change what we do in order, because, you know, this band is pretty physical.
Yeah, and yeah, totally.
You know,
there's still a lot of jumping around on stage,
there's jumping to be done, and I don't know if I can just keep that up infinitely. Yeah. I mean, I know. I can't.
But you still love the tour. You still, you know, are still gung-ho about that stuff.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, how has touring changed for you since the old days?
Well, it's more compact, and we take no days off whatsoever.
Really?
Know? Yeah.
Like, so it's like boom, 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 boom.
We'll be doing 21 shows in 21 days.
Really?
In May and June in Europe.
Now, is that because other people have, like, family lives and they need to get back?
And jobs. And
Right. That's got to be pretty taxing, though, man.
It can be. You know, the most important thing, I think, is, you know, I've learned over the years is to just make sure you get enough sleep.
Right. Yeah. So no real late partying.
Well, that just sort of happens sometimes. You know, I mean, we generally do not tour with a bus, and we did it like once in 95 in Europe, and we did it last year, and because the drives were getting that we had, we were looking at super long drives, and so the idea was just to, like, well, at least we can sleep on the bus and wake up in whatever town, so maybe we'll have some time to look at the town for a little while, instead of, you know, what we had been doing before is, like, you get back to the hotel room around, like, 2 or 3, and then you have to get up at 8 to make the drive to get there and sound check. Or not be out of the hotel by 8, you know.
Right.
You're not getting anywhere near the necessary sleep. Hey, kids, this is a boring part of the podcast.
No, not at all, man. I find this stuff endlessly interesting.
But so the theory was, like, we'll be on this bus and just be able to go to sleep and sleep however we want to. And of course, like, the first several nights, it's just like, we're on a bus, we have all this booze. You know, just, like, stayed up talking, and, you know, we weren't adjusted to the time either.
Right.
You know, I think.
Did your show suffer from that at all?
There was one show we did on that tour in Paris, and it was an outdoor festival, and it took like 20 minutes into the show before my voice started kind of halfway doing what I wanted it to do.
Right.
And it was just like, oh God, this is so off key and weak, you know, there's no strength to it, but then it kind of loosened up. I don't know if it was because it was kind of it was like an outdoor in the park kind of free thing at probably about like 2:30 in the afternoon. So maybe it was just because it was like earlier in the day and we'd played in London the night before and stayed up super late, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Is there still an amount of excitement for playing, like going on a European tour like
this?
Oh
yeah. Yeah.
Like getting up in front of.
I get nervous before every show we do.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah.
Yeah. No matter how big or small.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. There's just this weird, you know, butterflies.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I get that. Yeah. Have you always, because I...
Well, you know, you want it to be good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, totally. Totally. I get nervous. I used to play in a band, and it wasn't, you know, it was nothing big. But I would constantly get nervous. Whether we were playing in front of, well, actually, I'd be more nervous if we were playing in front of 5 people than if we were playing in front of 100.
Right.
You know? And now, since I don't play live music anymore, but now I do these hosting gigs, like, that's when I really, like, I've noticed that, like, my nerves are really bad. Because there's not an instrument that you get to hide behind. And, like, I've, I, I've been watching a lot of videos of Mudhoney performances and stuff. And I always thought of you as like, you know, the rhythm guitar player for the band. But I've been noticing in a lot of these videos, you are just singing.
Yeah, the last record, I didn't, not the very last record, not the new one, but the previous one, Lucky Ones, I didn't play guitar at all on it.
Really?
And on this record, The Vanishing Point, I play guitar in four out of the 10 songs.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's like six that I get to hop around on.
Yeah. So was that a big change though? Like for you?
Well, no,
and a big
it wasn't,
nerve-wracking thing once you got up
that
on stage
was, you
without
know,
a guitar?
That's what I did with Green River and with Monkey Wrench. And when I toured with the remaining members of the MC5, that's what I did with them too.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, I've been doing that for a long time too.
Yeah. It always seems like more, I don't know, to me there's like, you know, when you have an instrument in front of you, it's almost like it kind of guards you from things a little bit.
Yeah, you
right?
know.
You got something to hang on to, something to do with your hands.
Singing and playing guitar, in some ways I feel kind of more vulnerable.
Really?
Like I've had my teeth knocked out because I'm not holding on to the mic.
Ah.
Not knocked out, but like chipped. You know.
Oh, I see.
Wild
okay.
shows. When
yeah,
like
yeah, yeah, totally.
People are bumping up, you know, inadvertently against the mic stand and just knocks me in the face.
See, I don't get that because I never had anybody knocking up against the mic stand. Everybody's at least 10 feet, 15 feet away from the stage when I've played. That's the difference right there. Yeah. Well, I'm happy to hear that you guys still enjoy touring and it's still a fun thing. And of course, you know, you probably wouldn't be doing it still if it wasn't.
Right.
So where are you guys going on this next tour in support of Vanishing Point?
Well, the very next tour is tomorrow, and it's Portland.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
it is tomorrow.
We're playing Portland and Seattle on Saturday.
Oh, excellent. Nice.
When is this going to air?
This is actually going to go up, let's see, next weekend.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So that... By the time this goes up,
yeah.
we'll have played our record release shows here
yeah,
in the
yeah.
Northwest. But and then we're going to California for a weekend in April.
Cool,
like the weekend of the 12th, 13th. Playing San Francisco, San Diego, and L.A. And then in early May we play Boston and Brooklyn and Manhattan, and then a little later in May we go to Europe for those 21 shows.
Oh, excellent.
And then
cool,
we do a weekend that's a festival in Denver, a show in Minneapolis with the Melvins and Negative Approach and Die Kreuzen, which I'm really looking forward to that, and then another show with the Melvins that's in Minneapolis and another show with the Melvins in Milwaukee. And let's see, then we're doing like a 10-day U.S. tour that's kind of around a thing in Memphis called Goner Fest. So it'll be like kind of 10 shows around between like Washington, D.C. and Texas.
Oh, cool. Right on.
And and then I think there's Memorial Day weekend. I don't know if this is fully set up, but there's talk that it's probably going to be like Chicago, Detroit, and Toronto and Montreal.
Wow.
So, you know, that's, you know, for
a good
us,
amount of work,
that,
man.
That kind of covers a good chunk of the states, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like we've never really been very good at like hitting the kind of like secondary markets and whatnot.
Right, right.
Like even when we used to tour a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
secondary markets. I hate that term. It just sounds so
You're
dickish.
Speaking like a businessman
now. It sounds
now.
So dickish. Like, yeah, you know, your secondary markets there, like your Spokane.
Oh, man. So one last question before we go here, Mark. I know you've got a lot of things on your plate.
I have absolutely nothing on my plate.
Well,
I'm in the dining room. I don't even have a goddamn plate.
Do you want one? We've got some leftover chicken.
Oh, you
we
know,
can,
that would
we
be delicious.
Yeah, yeah. I should have brought that stuff out. Maybe a cheese and cracker arrangement. But you do have a movie that you need to go see tonight. So Is there, at any point in your career, has there been a time that you have thought that Mudhoney could do better, or you have wished that Mudhoney had done better, had been a bigger thing?
I don't know about being a bigger thing. I mean, I wish I would have done things better personally.
Yeah.
And this is, again, talking about the early 90s. You know, I was, like, pretty fucked up on drugs. And
yeah, yeah.
I think, you know, wasn't really there when we did our, you know, the record that reached the biggest audience right away, which was Piece of Cake, you mm-hmm. know. I think I don't really have any regrets. I don't even know if, you know, I wish I had done things differently, because I kind of learned stuff, you know, grew through whatever stupid, you know, I kind of learned things the hard way.
Right, right.
You know, and I kind of feel lucky that I came out the other end okay, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think it would have been a much better record had I been firing on all cylinders and being a more active participant with the rest of the guys.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a great place to end it, man. And I really appreciate you coming out. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. I hope you've enjoyed it.
I have enjoyed it,
okay,
Aaron.
Okay, good. Good. So we're going to do this. The record Vanishing Point is out now. And you can buy it at all of your record stores. You can go online. Go to, is it mudhoney.com?
Actually, the best place to buy it is through the Sub Pop website.
Through Sub Pop?
Yeah.
Okay. Go to subpop.com and check this record out. And that's the best place to buy it for you guys too, right?
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Wonderful. Okay, we're going to go out today.
Well, I mean, you know, if you want to support your local record stores like Easy Street and Sonic Boom, we're more than happy that you do that too.
Yeah, yeah. I always like to like find out what's the best and most lucrative way for the bands themselves.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I guess it would be to buy it at our show.
There you go. Buy it when they're on tour.
Well, don't wait. Don't wait, because we're not going to be touring that. Not much.
Oh man. Well, just get the record. Believe me, it's fantastic. And if you were a fan of Mudhoney back in the day, this is going to bring you right back to where you used to be. So,
for better or worse.
Right. For some of us, for worse. But you know, yeah, whatever. Who's counting? We're going to go out today with the song I Like It Small. And Mark, thank you once again, man.
Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah.
It was fun.
I hope you enjoyed your water.
The water's delicious. Really good water in these parts.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something about it. This is I Like It Small. We'll be back next week with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Have a good weekend.